The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's move to something of the national interest in Reader's Digest. As a drug epidemic invades even the nation's reading rooms, an unlikely group of first responders is joining the battle to save lives. Librarians who rescue opioid victims. And there's a picture of a young woman with glasses talking on the phone. Looks like she's got a couple of movies to check out, but she looks like a librarian, if you know what a librarian looks like. Cheryl Kowalski's official job is librarian at Philadelphia McPherson Square Library. A crowd hovered over the man lying on the grass as his skin turned purple. Cheryl Kowalski crouched next to his limp body, a small syringe in her gloved hand. Squeeze. The antidote filled the man's nostril. The purple faded. Then it came back. Kowalski's heart raced. We only gave him one, and he needs another, she called to the security guard at McPherson Square Park, a tranquil patch of green in one of Philadelphia's roughest neighborhoods. He's dying, said a bystander as the tension mounted around lunchtime one weekend last summer. Where is the ambulance? Another woman begged. Squeeze. As the mist entered the man's nose, Kowalski dropped a second syringe and put her palm on his sternum. Need, need, need. Nothing. She switched to knuckles. Need, need, need. By the way, that's K-N-E-A-D. Then a sound like a breath. The heroin metamethamphetamine overdose that had gripped the man's body started to succumb to Kowalski's double hit of the recovery drug Narcan. With help, the man sat up. Paramedics arrived with oxygen and more meds. Death had been held to bay again. Kowalski headed back across the park toward the century-old cream-colored building where she works. She's not a paramedic, the guard Sterling Davis said later. She's a teen adult librarian, and she has saved 6 people since April. That's a lot for a librarian. Long viewed as guardians of the safe spaces for children, library staff members such as Kowalski have begun taking on the role of responders, first responders in drug overdoses. In at least a handful of cities, Philadelphia, Denver, San Francisco, Salt Lake City, New Orleans, and others, library employees are trained to administer the drug naloxone, also known as its brand name Narcan, which help reverse overdoses. As opioid abuse has continued to affect many parts of the country, libraries have frequently found themselves on the front lines, which is perhaps not surprising given that they often serve as daytime havens for homeless people and hubs of service in impoverished communities. In the past 2 years, libraries in Denver, San Francisco, suburban Chicago, and Reading, Pennsylvania have been among the sites of fatal overdoses. Narcan training has changed the odds. When a man overdosed in the bathroom at Denver Central Library in February 2017, security manager Bob Knowles rushed to revive him. The branch had received its first delivery of Narcan just hours earlier. Library workers had sought the drug after a fatal overdose at their branch, which is near Civic Center Park, a hangout for homeless people and a market for drugs. Knowles lost a brother 40 years ago to an overdose. I wish somebody had had Narcan for him, Knowles said. Cheryl Kowalski is a somewhat unlikely rescue worker. The 34-year-old librarian wears oversized sweaters and big glasses. She reads nonfiction about World War II and zones out on Netflix. She chose to work at the McPherson Square Library partly because of her personal history. Her parents had been heroin users. They'd been clean for more than 20 years, and her mother earned a college degree in her 50s. Her father, a Vietnam veteran, worked as a truck driver until retiring, she says. But Kowalski knows what it's like to live in the turmoil of addiction. I understand the things the kids are seeing, she says. It's not normal. It is, unfortunately, their normal. When a drug user overdoses at or near the McPherson Library branch, Kowalski takes a minute to switch the headset from librarian to medic, she says, then springs into action. When she got word that day about the man who had collapsed in the grass, Kowalski reached into her desk drawer and pulled out a blue zippered pouch containing Narcan and the components required to deliver it. As she dashed out of the library, someone asked someone to call 911. You're under a time limit, Kowalski says. It's how fast can I do this? When she walked away a few minutes later, she felt relieved. He would live. I understand where they're coming from and why they're doing it, she says of heroin users. I just keep faith and hope that one day they will all get the chance to get clean. A lot of things have to line up perfectly for people to enter recovery long term. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, deaths from overdoses of prescription drugs and heroin have quadrupled since 1999 and are the leading cause of unintentional death for Americans. From 2000 to 2016, more than 600,000 people died of drug overdoses. Some of those deaths resulted from abusing legal painkillers such as oxycodone or Percocet, and some were from heroin, the hardcore opioid that some people turn to when their legal pain prescription runs out or becomes too costly. Opioids work by attaching themselves to the areas of the brain that control pain and emotions, the same way the body's natural neurotransmitters end up, such as endorphins do. When the body can't fight off all pain, the drugs help by driving up levels of the feel-good hormone dopamine, which can create the feeling of euphoria. Yet as the brain becomes accustomed to the good feelings, it often takes more and more drugs to produce them, leading to dependence and addiction. Hailed as a miracle remedy, naloxone short-circuits the effects of opioids. More than 26,000 overdoses have been reversed since needle exchanges and other programs started distributing naloxone, by the way, that's spelled N-A-L-O-X-O-N-E, 2 decades ago. The CDC reports, pharmacies sell it over-the-counter, and many insurers cover both the injectable and nasal spray methods. The cost is about $150. Administering the nasal spray, as they do at McPherson, requires 4 steps. Unscrew the vial, put it in the syringe, screw on the nasal mister, squeeze out the medicine. McPherson Square Library has a wide, welcoming staircase punctuated by tall columns. It anchors the Kensington community, where residents drop in with questions about doctor visits and legal matters, and children eat meals provided by staff and play with rockets of the Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Mathematics program. In recent years, so-called drug tourists, people who travel from as far as Detroit and Wisconsin seeking heroin, started showing up in Kensington, which boasts perhaps the purest heroin in the country. Users would camp out in McPherson Square Park and shoot up in the library's bathroom, where nearly half a dozen people overdosed in the past 2 years, says branch manager and children's librarian Judith Moore. The problem got so bad that the library was forced to close for 3 days in 2016 because needles clogged the sewer system. The staff discovered a man in the bathroom with a needle in his arm. He toppled over and started convulsing. I heard his head hit the floor, Moore calls. A city employee had left a dose of Narcan at the library, but the staff didn't know how to use it. After that, administrators set out to get them trained, says Marilyn McPherson, who oversees McPherson and Marion Parkinson, who oversees McPherson and other libraries in North Philadelphia. Patients at McPherson now have to show ID to use the bathroom, Moore says, and overdoses have dropped dramatically. The American Library Association also created a sort of electronic digest for its members to help with visitors suffering from substance addiction. It directs librarians to advice on how to recognize opioid use, short of seeing someone with a needle, how to address it, and where to go for additional support. We can be partners in the solution of this problem, says Dooley Todaro, Ph.D., a former president of the American Library Association. Where to turn? Accepting the reality that I need help and knowing where to actually get it are the crucial first steps for anyone battling drug addiction. If you search the internet for where to get help for drug abuse, results are in the millions. Here are some resources you can trust. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration provides treatment referrals and support to find treatment at, and the website is findtreatment@samhsa.gov. and 1-800-662-HELP. The Veterans Crisis Line directs veterans and their loved ones to the Qualified Caring Department of Veterans Affairs responders through a conscientious toll-free hotline, 800-273-8255. AboveTheInfluence.com describes warning signs and offers resources for young adults who want to help themselves or a friend. The Partnership for Drug-Free Kids offers a toll-free hotline to assist parents who are seeking help for their children. 855-DRUG-FREE. The National Institute on Drug Abuse offers questions you should ask before starting treatment. It offers office support for families, drugabuse.gov. Narcotics Anonymous provides support during and after treatment. Visit na.org. Last year, opioids killed more than 1,200 people in Philadelphia, about 30% more than in 2016. Nearly half involved fentanyl, the powerful drug that killed Prince and Tom Petty. It is among the worst public health problems we've ever seen, and we have not seen the worth of it yet, says City Health Commissioner Thomas Farley, M.D. In fact, the situation is so dire that city officials are considering a radical experiment, establishing injection sites where addicts can shoot up under medical supervision in hopes that they won't overdose before finally getting treatment. The only way to get people to turn their lives around is to keep them alive long enough so they can do that, says District Attorney Larry Krasner. A handful of foreign countries have injection sites, but no American city has taken the controversial step of opening one. So library employees keep an eye out for overdoses. When Davis, a security guard, spots one, he tries not to alert the children. Kowalski's first save happened when a woman overdosed on a library bench after school. One dose of Narcan revived her. She got up and walked away. But when Kowalski turned around, several kids, all library regulars, were on the steps watching. I got really upset because I know what they were seeing, she says. Weeks later, she revived a man who overdosed on fentanyl and fell off a bench in front of the library. I might need to take a mental health day tomorrow, she said afterwards, but then her regulars arrived. She played games with them and helped them on their computer. By the end of the day, Kowalski says, I felt good again. Anagrams of Ernest Hemingway that could also be Hemingway titles. Seething, wary men, we earthly men sing. When gin may steer, anywhere gin met, Gina met. The enemy war sign, yes, new nightmare. Drama in real life. When two boys are sucked into a rip current off Florida's Gulf Coast, their fellow beachgoers crowdsource a risky scheme to save their lives. The human chain. And there's a picture of an oceanside view looking out and the surf coming in and a row after people holding hands reaching out for the child. For these struggling boys and their mother, help was so close and yet so far away. Even now, almost a year after their stunning act of group heroism, the dozens of people who risked their lives to save two boys from drowning in Panama City Beach, Florida, marvel at the memory. That tattooed home builder who had nearly drowned a year earlier, an Asian couple who didn't speak English, the grandmother who had recently survived two heart attacks and who would, before the boys were finally relayed to safety, suffer a third. One after another, they leaped into the rolling water, linked enough hands and arms to stretch nearly 100 yards into a riptide that threatened to swallow anyone who came near. There were people there that didn't know how to swim whatsoever, and they were up to their necks in water, holding on to other people, says Brian Ursary, the father of the two boys. The rescuer called it the human chain. The physical chain was indeed what rescued the boys, who were passed along from one person in the next until they were back to safety on the beach. But it was the deeply human aspect of the rescuer strategy that made it so remarkable. They could have gone about their day and not cared, says Brian, but they found good in their hearts to help do what needed to be done. This right here kind of renews your faith in humanity. The story begins on July 8, 2017, in Florida's hard work and cold beer panhandle. Members of the Ursary family, 8 in total, are enjoying an evening together at the beach as the sun sinks lower on the horizon. The two boys, Noah, 11, and Stephen, 8, take their boogie boards and stray into the waves without the grown-ups noticing. When the boys are about 70 yards from the shore, they realize that the ocean has tugged them out to sea. After trying and failing to paddle back in, they start waving and screaming for help. But the lifeguards have clocked out for the evening. There's a yellow flag flying, indicating caution, but most of the regulars can scarcely remember seeing any other color. The boys have been, and there's a picture here of the two boys. They're nice-looking young men. The boys have been struggling for several minutes when Brittany and Tabitha Monroe, a married couple from Georgia, stroll by. They don't see the boys at first, but then they hear them. If I hear help, I'm going to try to help if I can, Tabitha says. They leap into the water and easily reach the brothers, who are still in fairly shallow water, less than 6 feet deep. The women reassure the frightened boys and grab their boogie boards, then discover that they, too, are now in a world of trouble. They can't get back to shore and can barely and only occasionally tap the sandy bottom with their feet. After a few minutes, it's clear to the woman that they are all trapped in a rip current. Rips move perpendicularly to the shoreline and can quickly exhaust swimmers who try to fight them. A powerful one can sweep even the strongest swimmers out to sea. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports that 92 people drowned in a rip current in 2017. Safety experts warn against fighting the current and advise that anyone trapped in a rip should swim parallel to the shore until finally exiting its deadly belt. The women try to do just that, but no matter which way they try to swim, they find they're still stuck. Brittany, who has 8-year-old Stephen, is petite and struggling to keep her head above water. Panicking, she releases the boy and makes a frantic push for safety. By now, some teenagers have heard the commotion. One of the teens, a boy who is tall enough to keep his feet on the ocean floor, dashes into the water, grabs Brittany, and hauls her back to shore. Meanwhile, Tabitha can feel herself being pulled farther out. She is treading water, already exhausted, and beginning to despair now that she has tried to save both boys alone. The waves keep plunging her underwater as the boys bob along next to her. On shore, Brittany is terrified and hysterical. A man heading back to his car says, "What's wrong?" asks Sean Jernigan. "My wife is drowning," Brittany says. Sean looks out and sees the trio of heads popping through the waves. A hulking house framer from Georgia, he immediately strides into the water despite an unusually powerful reason not to. A year ago, Sean was caught in a rip current in this very spot and narrowly escaped drowning. He is uncomfortably familiar with that feeling of the water lapping about his nose and ears as the vacuum cleaner current pulls the sand out from under his feet. Still, he wades out as deep as he dares, up to about his chin, until he knows he is at the brink of no return. A gaping 15 feet still lies between him and Tabitha and the boys. She is screaming for help, and he can't bear to abandon them. But he knows that if he continues, he'll become another victim. He turns around. "Please don't leave me," Tabitha pleads to the hulking stranger. "I'm fixing to die." "I'm not leaving," Sean answers. "I'll be right back." It's about this time that Roberta Ursary, the boy's mother, returns from the bathroom and looks around for her children. She is shocked to see them floating with their boards much farther out than they're allowed to go. She hollers at them to come ashore, and they scream through their tears that they're stuck. A bolt of panic fires her. She flings her phone into the sand and sprints into the water. She fights the waves to get to her screaming sons and the stranger who is trying to save them. "I'm going to help you," Roberta says. "I'm going to get you all out of this." She seizes the boys' boards and starts kicking for shore, but she quickly discovers the truth of their predicament. It's nearly impossible to make headway in any direction. By now, other people have begun to notice the stranded group, though the gravity of the situation isn't entirely clear. A few yards away, an Asian couple are treading water and trying to inflate a child's ring-shaped flotation device. They likely came out to help the boys, but when Roberta tries to talk to them, she runs into a language barrier. Just beyond them is a young man on a surfboard attempting to catch waves. Tabitha and Roberta scream at him for help. They note if they can all cling to the surfboard, they'll survive until a rescue boat comes. But the surfer laughs and paddles away. Roberta sees her grown nephew, Justin Hayward, surface nearer the shore. He's been exploring the shallows underwater, oblivious to what was going on farther out. He can see now that his aunt and little cousins are in trouble. Even though he broke his hand playing football on this same beach just a week before, he swims hard for the boys. "Don't come out here," Roberta says. "We're going to drown." He swims to them anyway. "Give me one of the boys," he tells his aunt. Roberta can't bring herself to relinquish either of her children. Justin finally persuades her to give him 11-year-old Noah and sets out to tow him on his boogie board toward the shore. But Justin, too, comes to understand that he is no match for the force of the water. Fortunately, more help is on the way. Sean Jernigan, the home builder who almost drowned the year before, has told his daughter to call 911. And return to the water's edge. Sorry about that. He is frantically searching for a rope or other life-saving equipment when he sees a man running toward the water. He tries to stop him. "Don't go out there," Sean says. "We're trying to get them out." But Brian Ursary charges anyway. "That's my family out there," he says. Sean spots two police officers and rushes up to them. The officers later not only refuse to help, but also to attempt to stop him and any other would-be rescuers from entering the water. Deputy Police Chief Chad Lindsay later says in a televised interview that the officers thought it was too risky to let anyone swim out to the boys. Sean ignores them and instead flags down a few other beachgoers, and together they start to wade into the water. To keep from losing their footing in the current, they begin holding to one another. and that gives them an idea. Why not form a human chain extending from the beach all the way out to the struggling swimmers? As long as the farthest link stays connected to those whose feet are still firmly planted in the sand, they'll be safe. Of course, that will require more links, probably dozens of them. Sean spot Derek and Jessica Simmons, a local married couple in their 20s, on the beach, and they start rallying the folks who have been watching the drama with passive concern. Don't just stand there, Derek yells. There's got to be some hope left for humanity in some of you. Then the most astonishing thing happens. One by one, link by link, total strangers wade into the waves and grasp one another by the wrist, determined that no one will die on this beach today. Jessica Simmons is petite, but she's an unusually strong swimmer. As her husband Derek continues to recruit rescuers, she grabs two boogie boards and swims out past the still-forming line to see how she can help. When she reaches the end of the chain, she sees they're still 20 to 30 feet shy of the group of swimmers. A tall man at the end of the chain says to her, "Do you think you could get them close enough to where we could grab them?" "Yeah, I can do that," Jessica says. When she turns around, she sees her husband swimming just behind her. "I couldn't leave you out here," Derek says. Derek grabs Noah's board from Justin, who has been trying desperately to keep his young cousin over the human train, in part by plunging beneath the waves to walk on the ocean floor while holding the boogie board over his head. "I was telling the boy everything is going to be all right. Just stay on your board," Derek says. At one point, Noah falls off, and Justin grabs him by his britches and puts him back on the board. As soon as him got it to the end of the chain where Sean was, it was like lightning. Sean started passing him back, and you just heard the chain pull, 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 all the way back to the beach. Everybody on the beach pulling them in. Takes only a minute for the chain to ferry him back to the beach. Jessica has been helping little Stephen make his way over to the chain, which is now some 70 volunteers strong, and when he reaches it, he too is whisked ashore. Next comes Roberta, who is so exhausted that she blacks out just as Jessica helps her connect with the chain. The people pass along Roberta's limp body, one link to the next, and deposit her on the beach. It will be 5 minutes before she wakes up. As it turns out, that was a blessing, considering what's happening to her mother out in the ocean. Barbara Franz, 69, saw her two grandsons struggling and swam into the danger zone right after Justin, to fight the fact that he had two heart attacks in the past 2 months. Within minutes, the water overwhelmed her. She's still out in the water when Roberta and the boys are conveyed to shore. In fact, she doesn't realize they have been rescued, and she sinks into hopelessness as her body continues to fail her. Justin tries desperately to float his grandmother along on a boogie board, but she keeps flopping off, her limbs like spaghetti. Over and over, the waves hit them, and she goes under, and Justin brings her back up, being careful of his broken hand. Derek swims up to assist. By now, Barbara has become delirious and incoherent. She's telling me, "Just let me go. Save yourself," she says. And there's a picture here of Barbara Franz, in the hospital bed with her daughter. Apparently realizing the gravity of the situation, the surfer has returned and given his board to the Asian couple. "I just remember saying, 'God, give me the strength to get this lady up on that surfboard, or we're both going to die today,'" Derek says. "It was just like a burst of energy I had. I picked her up and just chucked her into the middle of the couple that is hanging onto the board, and that's where she stayed, and when we probably got 10 feet from the chain, and then there was another boogie board. We ended up getting her on that." Somehow Justin swims to the end of the chain to add a link and ensure that his grandmother is taken ashore. When the next to him grabs his injured hand, Justin hears the bones rebreaking. The man recoils, but Justin says, "It's okay." Moments later, they shuttle the Asian couple down the chain, and Justin and a stranger carry Barbara onto the beach. She appears lifeless, but a moment later begins vomiting seawater. She later sheds that she felt her dead husband, Carl, appealing to her while she was unconscious, and she believes that she herself was dead for part of the ordeal. Barbara spent a few days in the hospital and months recovering from what turned out to be her third heart attack. Now everyone is ashore except for Tabitha, who flounders about 20 feet from the end of the chain, and the boy's dad, Brian. Tabitha is beyond exhausted, beyond despairing. "Hold on, baby girl," Brian tells her. "I got you." Again and again, he digs the tips of his toes into the sand and tosses her forward, and again, the seas undoes his feeble progress. Sean and the others in the human chain see what's happening, and the shout goes out to move the rescue operation down the beach, closer to where Tabitha has driven. There's a great scrambling in the surf, and a moment later the chain reforms, aligned to rescue Tabitha. A fresh swimmer splashes up to you. "Come on, grab my arm," he says. Tabitha reaches for him, and he tugs her the last few feet over to the chain, which zips her back to the beach. In the meantime, Brian finds his footing and wades in on his own steam. Everyone miraculously has made it. The vast majority of the rescuers from that day remain anonymous. The teen who helped Brittany ashore, the lanky young man who swung Tabitha in, the Asian couple, each deserve to be celebrated, but won't be. This humbles the usuries beyond words. It doesn't matter what color you were, what age you were, Brian says now. Everybody stopped what they were doing. They got off their phones, tablets, whatever, and helped get my family out of the water. Those people on that beach that day were angels on earth, says Roberta. Whether it's the first person or the last person in that chain, they were our heroes. Every link was just as important as the other one. Haven't I seen you somewhere before? Folding on multiple failed attempts to sleep in my bed, my 3-year-old came creeping in wearing sunglasses. After being denied once again, she said, I tried a disguise this time. I thought sure it would work. That's outrageous. He might have gotten away with it if only. He'd been less of a neatnik. A Florida man who'd broken into and ransacked a cell phone store thought of everything. He even shut off the power to the building to disable the surveillance camera and sprayed the glass display counters with Windex to remove his fingerprints. Yes, he thought of everything, except for the Windex. He left it behind, and the police lifted his fingerprints from the bottle. He'd worn a belt. A man snatched the cash drawer from a church gift shop in Florida and took off, pursued by a church worker. The worker might not have caught up with him, except the chief's oversized pants slipped down to his ankles and tripped him. He might have gotten away with it if he had made his car payment. An Illinois man drove to a Walmart, shoplifted some electronic devices, and then nonchalantly sauntered out to the door. That's when he noticed a problem. His car was gone. A repo agent had followed him to the store and repossessed the auto while he was inside. Police arrested the thief while he tried to flee on foot. He might have gotten away with it if only he'd looked behind him. A New Jersey man sneaked behind the counter of a convenience store and stole 9 packs of cigarettes. Also in the store and watching him the entire time were 2 men wearing bulky vests with the quite conspicuous word police emblazoned on them in large white lettering. He might have gotten away with it if he'd brought a flashlight. Around 2 a.m., a thief broke into a church in Germany and in the pitch dark groped around for the light switch. He found a slew of switches and flipped all of them. Suddenly the church bells started booming. The surprised man hurriedly grabbed a wooden figure and fled outside, where he was arrested. Okay, let's switch over to Consumer Reports for the last half hour of our program. Last week we were dealing with the fact that dressers are falling over and killing people, mainly small children. So let's go ahead and continue that. We stopped off where a part where it was talking about the consumer's conundrum. Under the current system, consumers must put their trust in manufacturers. The normal consumer has no clue, says Lisa Seifert, a consumer advocate in Barrington Hills, Illinois, who founded Shane's Foundation shortly after her 2-year-old son, Shane, died from a dresser flip-over in 2011. Like McGee, Seifert found her son under his dresser after he had taken a nap. She had assumed the dresser was safe. Jackie Collins' son, Curran, died in 2014 after a dresser tipped over onto him in his room at West Chester, Pennsylvania home. I just feel like it shouldn't be left up to the consumer, Collins says. Keisha Boyles of Conway, Arkansas, lost her 2-year-old daughter, Chance, in 2012. Chance and her then 16-year-old brother, Brandon, were playing in and out of each other's rooms. Boyles was in the bathroom when a dresser and a TV on top of it fell onto Chance, who died later from her injuries. I had no idea that they made anything to strap down furniture, Bowles says. Acting chairman of the CPSC, Anne Marie Burkle, says it's key to educate consumers about securing dressers and TVs already in their homes. Even if we put a mandatory standard into effect tomorrow, there's a lot of dressers out there that don't comply. Our testing of tip-overs. The voluntary standard for dressers is managed by the ASTM International, an independent organization that brings together manufacturers, government officials, academics, retailers, consumers, and others to establish standards for thousands of products and processes. Consumer Reports is an active member and participates in working groups, including dressers. Not all manufacturers participate, and not all comply with this voluntary standards. In CR's investigation, the Pottery Ban, Accurate Design, and Souder models were evaluated among others. passed all three of CR's tests. Other models from various manufacturers passed the first two tests, but failed our tougher third test. Five models from three manufacturers, Ameriwood, one model, DaVinci, one model, and South Shore, three models, did not pass CR's second test. Ameriwood and South Shore told CR their dresses meet voluntary industry standards. Three of the four dresses from these manufacturers that failed CR's second test were 30 inches or shorter and would not be subject to the industry's voluntary standard. DaVinci's told CR in an email that the company has already discontinued the model that didn't pass the second test because the company adopted a new 55-pound internal test. Any items that did not pass were either discontinued or underwent construction changes, which included thicker, heavier back panels, the email says. CR's testing shows the industry, in many cases, could already meet tougher standards with 13 of 24 dressers passing the 64-pound test. Still, meeting new standards would not be a simple adjustment, says Joe Shamel, co-president of Delta Children, a global manufacturer of cribs, furniture, baby gear, and dressers. Shamel says that it would mean redesigning for dressers and probably additional per-unit costs for back weights and extra shipping charges from Asia. As it is right now, my costs are more expensive than the guy that does not pass the voluntary standards, he says. If they make the voluntary standards tougher, my costs will continue to go up, while his costs will continue to be much lower than mine. Shammy, who considers himself a dedicated safety advocate, estimates Delta budget for safety testing is $2 million a year. The company culture is set around safety and corporate and social responsibility, says Shammy. His father started the business in 1968. It's not about the letter of the law. It's about using a combination of some common sense and seeing how it could apply further, because children do things that we don't anticipate. Five of the dresser models CR tested went from Delta. Three passed all three tests, and two passed tests 1 and 2, but failed CR's 60-pound test. In addition to Delta, CR contacted dozens of other furniture manufacturers and retailers to ask a series of questions about design changes, testing, and current safety standards. Of the 13 manufacturers that responded in full and also produced dressers, 8 said they want a mandatory standard. Why? To keep consumers safe and require a level playing field across all suppliers, David P. DeFonte, Senior Manager of Global Quality Assurance and Testing at L.L. Bean, says in a written response. Laura Wood, International Sourcing Coordinator at Lexington Home Brands, said the mandatory standard would eliminate confusion and debate. Incidents continue to occur because compliance with the standard, and more specifically understanding of the standard, is not consistent, she says. I think issuing a mandatory standard could certainly clarify for industry that a mandatory standard is mandatory. You have to do it. Who should be protected? Consumer advocates, including CR, think setting up a new tip over safety testing standard that is reasonable should be based on protecting more at-risk children. A mandatory 60-pound standard would cover about 95% of U.S. children under 6 years of age, a group involved in 82% of dresser and clothing storage unit tip-over deaths, according to the CPSC. Even so, some in the industry say the current voluntary standard is working and that tip-over mishaps will happen regardless of new laws or standards. Do I think the standard is adequate? Yes, I do believe it's adequate in protecting the most affected at-risk population, says Bill Perdue, Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for American Home Furnishings Alliance, a 400-member industry trade group. I do, however, believe that there's always room to improve the standard. Perdue contends that tip-over deaths and injuries are largely due to noncompliant products. Tip-over incident reports don't usually include the dresser model involved, so it's hard to tell which specific models are responsible for the incidents. But in the case of fatalities, some dresser models are singled out for scrutiny by regulators and the industry. In the case of Ted McGee's death, the IKEA Malm dresser that fell on him was still on the market when he died in February 2016, even though it and another Malm model were linked to the deaths of two toddlers in 2014. Those two families each filed a lawsuit against IKEA in 2015 and also reported the incident to the CPSC. That same year, IKEA issued free anchor kits and urged consumers to stop using IKEA dressers. 27 million at the time until secured to walls. It wasn't until June 2016, 4 months later after Ted's death, that IKEA issued a recall for the Malm. The McKees sued IKEA in August that year, and the company settled with them and the other two families that December. IKEA didn't respond to CR requests for comment about Ted's death. But the company stressed in email responses that Consumer Reports that all IKEA addresses should be secured to walls. Elliot Kay, commissioner and past chairman of the CPSC, says having a mandatory standard tends to speed up the recall process. In many cases, the CPSC doesn't have the practical resources to quickly force recalls and must either successfully sue or gain industry cooperation. With a voluntary standard, there's no enforcement mechanism whatsoever. It's truly voluntary. Basically, what many in the industry are saying is, let's wait until more children are killed before we have to do anything. And that, to me, is that's morally reprehensible, Kay says. I'm not comfortable waiting. And when we know what there are concrete changes that can be made now that will save lives. The next thing is, what your smart TV knows about you. And there's a picture of a TV screen with a guy in a fedora hat and a black coat and black shoes holding a TV antenna and binoculars. Our exclusive testing of several brands reveals that broad-based data collection goes on routinely, and even that some TVs can be hacked right in front of your eyes. Here's how to limit your exposure. Most TVs for sale these days are smart, meaning you connect them to your home network through Wi-Fi or an Ethernet connection, and then stream movies and TV shows from Netflix, YouTube, and other services. That's convenient, but it comes with some potential privacy trade-offs. While you watch the TV, it may be watching your behavior, which apps you load, which shows you tune in, even the DVDs or Blu-ray disc you play. That represents a big change from the way TVs used to work. And the data collection, along with the potential exposure to Internet threats, made smart TVs a perfect place for Consumer Reports to launch a new series of tests to see how connected products handle privacy and security. How we tested. Our evaluation of smart TVs was CR's first test using the digital standard, a project we unveiled last year that sets expectations for how companies should handle their customers' information. There are a lot of TVs on the market, but most are just a handful of smart TV software platforms. To get a good cross-section, we brought 2017 TVs from five brands, LG, Samsung, Sony, TCL, and Vizio. Samsung and LG have their own smart TV software, and that's not the case with the other sets. The TCL that uses Roku TV, a system that closely resembles the software on Roku's streaming devices, and is also used in sets from Hisense and additional brands. The Sony TV uses Google's Android TV system, and Vizio uses Google's Chromecast, platforms that also appear in other brands' TVs. CR's finding about your security. Anything connected to the Internet has the potential to get hacked, whether it's a laptop, Wi-Fi security camera, or a television. In CR's best of test of smart TVs, we were looking for good security practices, says Maria Rechich, our oversees our electronics testing. Encryption of personal data or sensitive data, protection from common security vulnerabilities, that sort of thing. This approach is a bit like checking to see whether there are functioning locks on a house's doors. In two cases, there weren't. Our test showed that hackers could take control of TCL and Samsung sets over the Internet by exploiting simple security flaws. We were able to blast the volume, cycle through the channels, open YouTube content, all without the user's permission. The problems amounted to mischief and a sign of sloppy security more than significant harm. A hacker couldn't listen in on a family or somehow steal their Amazon credit card information. But if you didn't know what was happening, this sort of TV takeover might feel creepy, as though an intruder were lurking nearby. In a real attack, a hacker would need to trick you into downloading an app or going to a web page containing malware, or you were using a computer or mobile device on the same network as the TV. That might happen if you clicked on a link in a phishing email. In the case of Samsung, the user would need to access the malware using a phone or tablet that had previously been set up as a remote control for the TV. We contacted the companies involved. TCL referred us to Roku for questions about data collection and this vulnerability. A Roku spokesman said via email, "There is no security risk to our customers' accounts or the Roku platform," and pointed out that users can turn off external control features in the TV setting, although this would also keep them from using Roku's own mobile app to control the TV. In an email statement, Samsung said, "We appreciate Consumer Reports alerting us to the potential concern, and that the company was still evaluating the issue while also fixing some other less severe problems that were uncovered." CR's findings, your privacy. Your smart TV may be collecting a lot more information than you realize. When setting up one of these TVs, you need to shuffle through a series of screens with privacy policies, terms of service, and various options. Racing through, though, agreeing to everything, and you end up giving permission for a continual stream of data to be sent back to the manufacturer and perhaps its business partners. That includes information on what you watch and other types of data, too. For years, consumers have had their behavior tracked when they're online and using their smartphones, says Justin Brookman, Director of Privacy and Technology at Consumers Union. But I don't think a lot of people expect their television to be watching what they do. The viewing data is collected through technology called an automatic content recognition, which identifies every show you play on the TV, including cable, over-the-air broadcasts, streaming services, Blu-ray disc, and so on. ACR helps the TV recommend other shows you might want to watch, but it's also used for targeted ads and other marketing purposes. You can turn off ACR, which goes by a variety of names, including viewing information, without giving up functionality. But you sacrifice more if you don't agree to the TV's basic privacy policy in terms of service. Those agreements let companies collect information such as which apps you download, what devices you attach to the TV, where you live, and more, decline, and your smart TV won't connect to the Internet. How to protect yourself. If you have a new smart TV and want to block the collection of viewing data, pay close attention during the setup. There you typically can agree to the basic privacy policy and terms of service while declining ACR. If you've already set up your smart TV, you can go to the settings and turn off ACR. The right screens can be difficult to find, but go to cr.org/tvsnooping0518 for directions. To eliminate all data collection, your only option is to decline every privacy agreement. Just take the TV off your home network. You can always add a separate streaming media device to get web-based content from Amazon, Netflix, and other sources. But those devices may have their own expansive data collection processes. Product updates. The latest readings from our labs. Wild about wireless? Tired of getting tangled up in headphone cords? Welcome to the world of wireless. If you go shopping for headphones this spring, you'll discover quicker than you can stream Despacito that the world has gone wireless. In recent months, Google, HTC, and Motorola have followed Apple's lead and eliminated the headphone jack from their latest smartphones. And according to the market research firm NPD, 69% of every dollar spent by U.S. consumers on headphones in 2017 went to models that link mobile devices via a Bluetooth connection instead of a cord. Our customers are living life on the go, said Jacob Christofferson, design and concept manager for the headphone maker B&O Play. Freedom is not just a choice, but a prerequisite for their products. These moving and grooving shoppers are presented with a wide selection of wireless options, sports models that log your heartbeat as you exercise, noise-canceling models that electronically drown out the chatter at the local Starbucks, and true wireless models such as Apple's AirPods that pump Johnny Cash classics into your ears through two completely separate earbuds. Maria Reckage, Director of Electronics Consumer Testing at Consumer Reports, says Bluetooth headphones have not quite achieved the sound quality of the top wired models in our ratings, but many deliver very good sound, and a few Bose quiet comfort models even squeak into excellent territory. Van Colton, founder and CEO of the headphone manufacturer V-Moda, attributes recent improvements in wireless sound to upgrades in audio codecs, the software that processes your old Coldplay tracks before they reach your ears. The standards has been raised, says Matt Engstrom, Senior Category Director of Product Management or Headphone Maker, Shure, which says steady improvements to Bluetooth have made wireless connections more stable, too. They're also getting easier to set up. Apple's W1 chip, found in AirPods, AirPods, and select Beats headphones, lets you pair your iPhone with the push of a button. And the wireless near-field communication, NFC, tech found headphones such as the Sony WH-1000XM2 does much the same for Android smartphones. In the end, you don't have to pay big money for a Bluetooth connection and high-quality sound. The JVC HA-FX90BT Gummy Wireless, for example, sells for $30. and doesn't offer fitness tracking functions, noise cancellation, or voice-activated control like some higher-priced models, but the audio quality met our very good standard. Mastering wireless controls. Before you opt for all these high-tech features, though, you should look over the headphone specs. You may find that the built-in controls let you adjust the volume, pause the music, and answer a call without removing your smartphone from your pocket. Work only with either Android phone or an iPhone. It's easy to get confused by the touch models, touch controls that perform these functions on certain wireless models. The tap patterns can be so complex you almost need a secret decoder, Rickrick says. On other models, the controls may kick into action from an accidental touch, pausing your favorite song right when you're barreling into the grand finale. One last tip. The Bluetooth signal does not travel well through water, and the human body is flush with HTO, Rickrick says. So at times, some headphones might experience difficulty receiving signals from your smartphone. The easy solution? Move your phone to another pocket, one that's closer to the antenna in the headphone. That often does the trick, she says. Should you shop Amazon? Do you have to pay several hundred dollars for a pair of true wireless headphones? Clearly, plenty of people can't or won't, which is why on Amazon you'll find dozens of models that sell for less than $60. Are they any good? We purchased three pairs that earned almost 5 stars from at least 100 online reviewers. Then we put the $50 Parquet PA01, the $50 Ayishq YKT02, and the $60 SoundMove HV358 to the test in our labs. The Pahari delivered only fair sound, and we ordered it twice and both times received a model that differed slightly from the one we had selected. As for the Lakusu, which also rated fair, our tester said the sonic shortcomings leave a lot to be desired when listening to music. That means the earbuds are better suited for people who prefer listening to podcasts on a smartphone or movie dialogue on a laptop. The casual music fan may appreciate the SoundMove HV358, which crept into the good sound range. Many others, though, are likely to notice the boomy bass, thin and rough mid-range voices, guitars, horns, and overbearing treble. And then they have a brief review of about 9 different earphones at different prices, different things. There's the $50 or less, the JVC HV FX98B Gummy Wireless at $30. This 2000 pair delivers very good sound. If you hunt, you can still find it on shelves at Best Buy and Fry's Electronics. Motorola Moto Surround for $50. This contoured collar is comfy around the neck and keeps the earbuds handy when not in use, but the model faltered when pulled with Apple and mobile devices. Skullcandy, JB Wireless at $30. If you simply want good sound at painless price, these are worth a look. $50 to $100, Jabra, $80. This model lets you access the voice commands of a digital assistant such as Cortana, Google Now, or Siri. Samsung, Level Active, $80. The Level Active comes with a choice of earpiece pairs to help you with the fit. With one tap, you can access workout data via Samsung's fitness app. Sushi, Sport Clip Air at $60. Scorchy's Wired Sport Fix Flex 3 model delivers very good sound for $20. But on this $60 wireless pair, the sound is just fair. $101 and up. The Phantom BT220NC at $160. These provide excellent sound and muffle unwelcome distractions at a nice price, compared with Bose's $300 plus noise-canceling models. Samsung Gear Icon 218 at $190. You get very good sound, fitness tracking support for Google's digital voice assistants, and a built-in music player that stores up to 1,000 songs. Apple AirPods at $160. They're not the best true wireless model in our ratings, but AirPods deliver good sound and Apple extras such as voice activation music player controls. Although it's kind of hard to tell with the weather being what it's done the last few weeks, gas grills about to get fired up about. It is the time, just about the time of the year to break them out. And what we're going to do here is we're going to start this thing and we probably won't finish today, but we should be able to finish it. You should be able to get into it next week as well. It's easy to take a grill for granted. Stationed on a deck or patio, exposed to scorching sun, drenching rain, and heavy snow, it's ever at the ready to be fired up for parties, cookouts, family dinners throughout the year. Until it's not. On our most recent CR member survey of 6,800 gas grill owners, two-thirds reported they got five more and more useful years out of the last grill they owned. Still, all grills eventually need to be replaced, usually because of rusting, broken, or worn-out parts. And buying a new grill usually isn't as simple as choosing the same model as one you had. Manufacturers go out of business, styles and features changes, and the model you owned and loved may not be available anymore. It's been more than 2 years. Don't expect to find your old grill for sale, unless it's from a top-tier brand such as Weber or Napoleon, says CR market analyst Mark Allwood. You'll probably have to wade through a sea of various sizes and models as you decide, among other things, how big a grill you should buy, whether to get coated cast iron grates or stainless steel stainless hold up better, and whether it's worth spending more for a grill than it's built to last. To give you a head start, we've handpicked models in the most widely sold sizes across price ranges to highlight those our experts consider to be an exceptional value. We're also arming you with all the ratings and buying advice you need to find the grill that's right for you. Because grills vary widely in construction and materials, which can affect durability, we're introducing a new criterion in our ratings that measures sturdiness. And we'll tell you how to keep your grill in tip-top shape, when and where to find the best deals, and how to use our ratings of 109 models to make sure the grills you pick match your cooking style. Getting started. Begin your search for a new grill by deciding on the size, and bear in mind that bigger does not necessarily mean better. According to our survey, more than 60% of CR members who owned a gas grill have a midsize model, which is why more than half the gas grills in our ratings are midsized. This Goldilocks of grills is large enough for feeding a crowd. They can accommodate up to 28 burgers at a time, compact enough not to dominate your deck, and not too big for whipping up a quick meal of brats and grilled onions for a family of four. While small grills can equal the best larger models in cooking performance, shoppers who need only a small grill should still consider a mid-size model. Even if you don't really need the extra cooking area, a mid-size grill often has more features, such as illuminated controls and LED lighting, that you typically won't find on smaller grills, says Cindy Fisher, who oversees grill testing for Consumer Reports. Where to shop? According to TrackLine, a service that tracks consumer behavior and buying habits, 17% of U.S. consumers in a recent survey reported that they had bought their grills online. It's not surprising. A grill is a major purchase, and buying in a store lets you kick the tires, so to speak, and get a hands on the sense of the quality of construction. Of course, if you prefer to buy online, you can now rely on our sturdiness test to indicate how solidly a grill is built, but you still have to weigh the convenience of online ordering with the task of assembling the grill. If you're not intimidated by a box full of parts, check online retailers such as Amazon for the broadest selection of unassembled grills. Many offer free shipping. It's possible, too, to order online and have the grill assembled at your home. Amazon Home Services, which provides assembly or installation products for an upfront fee, will arrange for a local pro to build your grill. We printed out the service for three grills and found that, in each case, we'd have to pay around $140, although the cost depends on the type of grill, your location, and the service provider. On a handful of pricier models, Amazon provides free assembly. Walk-in retailers offer a less expensive option. Home Depot and Lowe's, for instance, will assemble grills free of charge at your local store, including models purchased on their website and shipped to the store. Some also delivery services for buyers who don't have a vehicle capable of getting the grill home. Here's some easy fixes for failing grills. Over time, grill components break, but that doesn't mean it's time to scrap your sizzler. Certain key parts can be easily replaced to keep your grill working like new. Here's how long you can expect parts to last and how much you'll pay to replace them. Cooking grates. Expected lifespan, 3 to 10 years. Cost to replace, $25 to $150 for a set. In our survey, nearly 30% of CR members who own a gas grill reported problems with grates cracking or flaking on a previously owned grill. They are easily replaced. To maintain them, clean each side with a stiff wire brush. Use nylon on porcelain-coated grates before grilling. Brush again and oil grates after cooking. Burner tubes. Expected life, 2 to 10 years. Cost to replace, $10 to $60 per tube. Nearly 40% of CR members reported uneven heating in a grill they no longer use. A leading cause? Clogged or damaged burner tubes. Sometimes the tubes are so damaged that they fail to light at all, which results in extremely uneven cooking. Burner covers. Expected lifespan, 2 to 8 years. Cost to replace, $5 to $30 each. 18% of CR members reported problems with uncontrolled flare-ups on a grill they previously owned. Burner covers, also called heat tents, shield the burner tubes from a dripping fat, helping control these. If covers on your grill are damaged or missing, replace them for better performance and for safety. Igniter ignition parts. Expected lifetime, 2 to 7 years. Cost to replace and assemble, $10 to $90. According to our survey, 92% of grills have electronic igniters. If your burners won't light, check the battery that powers the ignition. If only a single burner is affected, check the wire that leads to the igniter or the igniter itself next to the burner tube. How we test for testaments. Traditionally, CR has rated gas grills solely on how they cook. What we didn't test for was how well a model will stand the test of time or whether it might fall apart after a few seasons. In the past, we'd see cheap, flimsy grills rise to the top of our ratings because they did well in our temperature tests, says Cindy Fisher, our lead tester for gas grills. Fisher and other CR engineers wanted a gas grill ratings to reflect apparent differences in sturdiness. To make that happen, they spent 2 years building a proprietary machine that can torque and torture grills. When we dispatched our secret shoppers to buy new units of models already in our ratings, ran them through a new test, and with our in-house statisticians, developed a new scoring criteria based on the result. Here's how the test works. Engineers clamp each grill to a structural steel plate, prop open the lid, and connect something called a linear actuator to the lid's handle. The actuator travels along a stationary track, applying lateral force to the lid, while lasers measure the deflection up and down in a hundredth of an inch. This captures the degree to which the metal frame flexes or bows under stresses a grill might encounter over time, as from being moved. The best grills barely budge, and the worst suffer permanent damage to the frame or lid during the course of our test. We now factor structural integrity into each grill's overall score. Next week, we'll go ahead and read the ratings for the different grills they've done. But for now, we've just about run out of time at today's broadcast of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the reading service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to become a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.